You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good afternoon. My name is Richard Reeves. I'm a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and director of our Future of the Middle Class initiative. Thank you for joining us for this important event on economic security during the COVID pandemic and all the other problems and divisions and challenges that our nation faces at this moment in time. I'm going to briefly introduce our speaker and then our two panelists. You'll hear first from our speaker, then from our panelists, and then we'll open up for questions. Please do join in using the hashtag economic security. Send us your questions on Twitter so that I can address them to our speaker and to our panelists. And with that, I'll do brief introductions and then hand over to our first speaker. It's Jeff Larimore. Jeff is the Chief of Consumer and Community Research at the Federal Reserve Board. And today is going to be sharing the latest data on financial security based on the Fed's own surveys. You'll then hear the first response will be from my colleague, Camille Bousset, who's a senior fellow in governance studies here at the Brookings Institution, where she runs our Race, Prosperity and Inclusion Initiative. And I would just like to point out that just as of last week, Camille has launched a new blog at the Brookings Institution on race equity, which is called How We Rise. So I encourage you to check out that new product that Camille has launched at the Brookings Institution. And then you'll hear from Jenny Schutz, who is a fellow in the Metropolitan Policy Program at Brookings. And I just quick shout out to Jenny. It was actually her idea to bring this event together. So thank you for that, Jenny. Jenny is a housing policy expert and interested in alternative wealth building strategies more generally. And then once we've heard from both of our respondents, we'll have a moderated discussion among the three of the speakers today before opening it up to you for a broader question. So with that, I'm going to hand over to Jeff for his presentation.
Thanks, Richard. I'm excited to be here today and to be able to have this conversation with all of you and to discuss some of these results and how people are faring financially. Before I begin, I want to start by emphasizing the usual disclaimer on this slide. This presentation reflects my own views and doesn't represent the views of the Board of Governors. As some brief background on this survey, the Survey of Household Economics and Decision-Making has been fielded by the Federal Reserve near the end of every year since 2013 to monitor households' financial circumstances by asking people directly about their financial decisions. It also asks them to give their own subjective self-assessments of their well-being, along with more traditional objective financial outcomes, which helps provide a picture of people's financial lives as they're personally seeing them and not just our assessments of them. But also a key feature of this survey is having the flexibility to integrate new topics, which led to a decision to field an additional small supplemental survey the first weekend in April to understand the financial repercussions of COVID-19. So I'm going to share some results today, both from the main survey from October and the April supplement, as I think really both of them are important for understanding financial circumstances now, with the October survey giving us an understanding of how people were faring leading into the pandemic, while the April supplement provides information about the early stages of the public health crisis. I want to start by giving an overview of what we saw for family finances leading into the pandemic from the 2019 survey. So this figure shows the share of adults who self-report that they're at least doing okay financially. And in 2019, overall well-being using this measure was flat, with 75% of adults saying they were at least doing okay financially, but it remained 13 percentage points above where it was in 2013, so it was at a relatively high level relative to recent years. And I think this is very much consistent with what we see for other measures in the survey as well. The financial well-being has seen these modest improvements over time from 2013 up through 2019 before the pandemic occurred. Yet while most adults were doing at least okay financially at the end of last year, some of the financial challenges seen in the survey likely have implications for people's experiences in the current environment. And one of these challenges is income variability. In addition to asking about people's annual incomes, the survey asks whether people's income varies from month to month. And in 2019, 30% of adults said that they had monthly incomes that varied at least occasionally from one month to the next. In some cases, this volatility didn't really affect financial well-being much at all. but especially among people who lack credit access, we see that it often causes financial hardship. So as seen in this figure, nearly 4 in 10 people who are not confident that they could get a credit card said that their income varied at least occasionally from month to month. And about 3/4 of those who were not confident in their credit access said this variability caused them financial hardships during the year. So I think this has implications for how people are faring with income volatility since COVID-19 and their ability to smooth consumption in light of income declines, as those who lack credit access may have a harder time dealing with any short-term declines in income. This also can have implications for racial and ethnic disparities in weathering economic downturns, since there's this persistent gap in credit access by race and ethnicity. So here we can see the share of adults who are not confident that they could get approved for a credit card by race and ethnicity on the top, and on the bottom, the share who say they were denied on at least one application, looking just at those who actually applied for credit in the year before the survey. So most adults who wanted credit were able to obtain it, but there's this clear gap by race and ethnicity in the perceived credit access and in actual denials that may make it more difficult for Black and Hispanic adults to weather any short-term volatility through borrowing. Another area where we see differences in financial circumstances leading into the pandemic is between owners and renters. Across a range of measures in the survey, before the pandemic, homeowners were in a better position financially than renters were. And here we see 3 of those measures. At the top, homeowners, both those with and without a mortgage, were more likely to say they can pay all their current month's bills in full. A larger share of homeowners also say that they would pay an unexpected $400 emergency expense with cash or cash equivalent, which is if people who would be using a credit card that they pay off at the end of the month that they're really just using for convenience purposes. And similarly, owners are far more likely to say that they're at least doing okay financially. And of course, this also reflects many other aspects of people's financial situations. I'm not controlling here for other demographic characteristics, and homeowners tend to be older and higher income than renters. But while it's not necessarily attributable to their housing decisions, this does indicate the extent to which financial difficulties are more concentrated among those who rent relative to those who own. As a separate measure of financial preparedness, which is of course relevant with elevated rates of unemployment, is whether people are able to cover 3 months of expenses. This figure shows the share who say that they cannot cover 3 months of expenses, including by using savings, borrowing, or selling assets, so a relatively broad measure. Similar to that which we saw for other measures of well-being, renters are less prepared for extended income losses, as half of renters said they couldn't cover 3 months of expenses using any of these means. So with that context on financial situation from before the pandemic, and there's certainly a lot more in the survey as well that I can certainly talk about during the discussion, I now want to share some of the findings from early April on how people were faring relatively early in the public health crisis. And here I do want to pause and emphasize the timing of the survey to note that it was conducted the first weekend in April. So it was after the passage of the CARES Act, but before most benefits were received. This slide shows what we've seen from other data sources, that job losses in March and early April were certainly quite substantial. In the survey, we ask about a relatively broad measure of job loss, which includes anyone who says that they lost a job or were told not to work between the beginning of March and the first weekend in April, even if they're still working in some capacity at the time of the survey, such as if they had a second job that they maintained or if they found another job or picked up additional work. And we see that 13% of adults said that they experienced a job loss over this period. But in addition, 6% of adults said they weren't laid off, but that they had their hours reduced or took unpaid leave over this period. So collectively, 19% of all adults either reported a job loss or an hours reduction. And I'm going to focus later on some of the financial outcomes for this group in particular, this 19% of people. I want to stop and note, however, at least the bottom bar here, which I also find interesting, but I don't think gets as much attention. So 7% of people said that they either increased their hours or worked overtime. This is going to include some people who worked overtime or extra hours early in the month of March before subsequent closures, but it also reflects the fact that there are some people who are working additional hours in sectors that saw surges in demand, such as people who were producing or delivering goods bought online or people at grocery stores, these industries and occupations where there really was an uptick in demand in response to people's changes in purchasing patterns. In addition to the overall income declines, though, a notable aspect of work situations is the sharp education divide in employment, including where people are physically doing their work. So there was a difference in the likelihood of working from home by education last fall, but this difference is really magnified in light of the pandemic. So after the onset of COVID-19, a much higher proportion of workers of all education levels were working from home, but there was this large education divide here, as workers with a bachelor's degree were much more likely to say that they're working from home than those with less education. And note also that these statistics reflect people who are actually working in the week before the survey and don't include those who were laid off because they couldn't work from home. So to the extent that workers without a bachelor's degree were experiencing additional employment declines specifically because they couldn't work from home, it's then going to further magnify these differences by education shown here. And we can now think about how these job losses and hours reductions are reflected in various measures of financial well-being, which I think is really one of the big strengths of this survey. So the next three slides, I'm going to show a couple of these measures. On this slide is whether people expected to be able to pay all of their current months and bills in full in the month of the survey. So in the fall, 16% of people were unable to pay all of their bills in full. And this is actually really similar in April. So in April, 18% of all adults indicated that they didn't expect to be able to pay all their bills in full. So it's a slight uptick, but it's not really a statistically significant change. But these results for the overall population can then mask some of the challenges among those who either lost a job or had their hours reduced. So for those who didn't have a change in their employment status, financial stability, using this measure, looks pretty similar to what it looked like in the fall. But among those who had these employment disruptions, the rate of financial challenge was much higher, as 35% said that they wouldn't be able to pay all their month's bills in full in April. And this can be seen in other measures as well. So here I show the share who would pay a $400 expense using cash or its equivalent, which is one of the ways we track people's preparedness for small financial emergencies that might arise. So noting that this does reflect how people would pay the $400 expense and not necessarily whether they actually could pay, we do see that those who lost a job are far less likely to say that they would pay this type of expense using cash or credit card paid off at the end of the month, and they're far more likely to say that they would either borrow, sell something, or simply couldn't pay this expense. And turning now back, though, to the overall well-being measure that I started with, we can then see this very similar picture that a lot of the challenges really are concentrated among people who had these employment disruptions. So here I can turn back to the self-reported well-being measure that I started with the solid blue bars in this figure being the overall well-being results through 2019 that I showed on one of the initial slides. But I've added the April 2020 results on the right. And consistent with the findings for being able to pay bills, this spring we saw a modest decline in the share doing at least okay financially, which slipped back from 75% to 72%. But as seen in the dashed orange bar on the far right, which just looks at those who had a job loss or had their hours cut, this decline was really concentrated among people who had these employment disruptions. So about half of this group said they're doing at least okay, whereas the other half are showing greater financial struggles. And again, people who didn't experience these employment disruptions really looked very similar to what they looked like in the fall for this overall well-being measure. And so finally, I want to end by pulling this back to the education results for employment that I showed earlier and this difference in people's ability to work from home and continue working by the level of education they have. So here I show the trends in the same self-reported well-being measure, but now split out by education over time. So those with more education consistently report higher rates of well-being, but improvements over time between those with and without a degree were similar from 2013 through 2019, each rising by about 12 to 13 percentage points. However, this wasn't the case at the start of 2020. So in early 2020, after the onset of COVID-19, those with a bachelor's degree were equally as likely to say that they were doing okay as was the case last fall, but there was a 5 percentage point drop for those with less education. So I think this is really consistent with the idea that both the fact that people with less education have thinner financial buffers, as well as the higher rates of job loss and difficulty working from home during the pandemic for this group. And so I think this gives a sense of how some of the observations from our survey and from elsewhere about the concentration of job losses can then translate into concentration of broader financial challenges at the start of the public health crisis. So I think this gives us an overview of some of the highlights from the survey and the way that I've been thinking about the results. Although there certainly is a lot more that's included in the survey that I'd be happy to discuss as well. But with that, I want to go ahead and turn it back to Richard, and I'm certainly looking forward to the discussion with all of you today. So thank you.
Thanks, Jeff. Thank you for those fascinating results and the way that the crisis is touching Americans differently in terms of their finances or leaving some untouched and deeply affecting others. So with that, I'm going to hand to Camille, who among other things is an expert on financial well-being from her previous roles as well as her current work on equity. So Camille, I'd love your reactions both in terms of the short and long-term implications of what you've heard.
Yeah, absolutely. Jeff, I want to say that was an excellent presentation. I always look forward to looking at the SHED data. And I really find this particular couple of iterations, sort of pre-April and then the April piece, to be an important real-time view of the way in which the unfolding COVID-19 economic recession is being experienced at the household level. So I think it's a great peek into that, and obviously an early peek into that. And things have deteriorated since then. So one thing I do want to point out before I get going into my comments is that, you know, in April 2020, and Jeff, you may want to comment on this, I think there were still a lot of people who felt like the economy was going to bounce back pretty quickly. And, you know, subsequent to that, we now know that that's not the case. And so I think some of the way people think they were doing was probably predicated on the sense that, you know, disruptions would be short term. Do you have any insights into that, Jeff?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely right. This survey really is a snapshot into people's experiences in early April at the very start of this public health crisis. And I mean, we also look at this, right, for example, at people's expectations for reemployment. And at the time, of people who said they had a job loss, something like 90% said they expected to go back to the same employer. So it was a really high share. And you're right. I think that one of the big questions in all of this is it's not a two-week crisis. We're now middle of June, so several months later. And it is this question of how long is it going to take before we're back to more normal situations, certainly.
Yeah, great, thank you. So I wanted to just touch on three points. The first is that one of the things that I think is really highlighted by this data, both the pre-COVID and the post-COVID data, is the financial fragility of those with less than a bachelor's degree. And obviously that has been exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic, but there are a number of measures there, one of which, Jeff, you had mentioned, which is income volatility, and that and the coincidence with gaps in credit access, to me, speak volumes about the fragility of this particular set of people. So these are folks who really, in some ways, they may have been more employed than they were in 2013. They may have experienced better employment, but the sense of fragility is still pretty high, I think, for those folks. And I think that comes through pretty clearly in a number of measures. So that's number one. Number two is this enduring chasm between Blacks and whites' financial well-being. And it's obviously something we've been talking about a lot as a nation. But what I was struck by here is the range of indicators that demonstrated the depth and dimensions of that wealth gap and have implications for the room for maneuver to weather the current economic recession. And as we know, in the prior economic recession, Blacks ended up doing much worse than whites on average. In navigating that recession, home ownership dropped significantly, and I'm sure that Jenny will comment on that. But also, it took Blacks a lot longer to get moving after the recession formally ended. And so one of the things that I saw there and I thought was actually really pretty interesting was there was a section on unpaid, on justice and involvement with the justice system and then unpaid legal debt and fees related to that involvement. And for Blacks, it was extremely high. And so not only is there, a sense of historical gap due to all sorts of policies and to racism, but also as Blacks experience interaction with certain systems. So for instance, the financial system, there's less access to credit. With the legal system, there's debt that builds up. And so in every sort of facet, you see this gap and this kind of fragility really played out. And that you know, to me, demonstrates that we have a long way to go in a solution because it's sort of that gap has permeated basically every part of a Black person's experience on average. We add to that, all the information we're getting right now on the COVID-19 recession. The National Bureau for Economic Research just put out a paper that showed that 3.3 million small businesses were shuttered over the last 3 months. And that was more than closed during the Great Recession. And most of these businesses, it turns out, are heavily minority owned and immigrant owned businesses, the ones that went under. So we also have some pressure there on the income side for small business owners. And then, of course, the Fed chair has repeatedly highlighted the impact of the economic recession on communities of color. So that picture looks really quite troubling, I would say. And I think speaks to a need for comprehensive and far-reaching policies and income supports in general. And then the last thing I'll say before I turn things over to Jenny is when we see a big drop-off in employment and in security and financial well-being that we're seeing due to the COVID-19 crisis. And, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty about when COVID-19 will become less of a crisis. I think it becomes really important for us to think about what does it mean to be middle class in a situation like this when so many people are really under a lot of stress. And I know, Jeff, this is not something that the Shed focuses on, but it is something that I think we should add to the picture, which is the amount of hunger that Americans are experiencing as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic. And so when you think about all the people who are lining up at food banks, and many of them would have considered themselves middle class 4 months ago, I think when we think about policies and how we, how we are going to deal with a lot of the stress and the economic recession more generally, we also have to think about the fact that the notion of the middle class might really have been changed. And so, just something for us to think about as we move forward. I'm going to stop my comments there and turn things over to Jenny.
Thanks, Camille. I just wanted to interject with one question, Jenny, which I think you will get to, you may well get to in your remarks, but I also want to underline this point about fragility and the Future of the Middle Class Initiative. We're interested in the quality of life for the middle class and mobility up into the middle class. But as Camille's just pointed out, there is this sense of fragility and the risk of downward mobility that people might face as well. And something like the pandemic could expose their differential risk of downward mobility as a result of that. One of the questions we've already had in advance from Chris Jackson at the Overland Park Chamber of Commerce, Jenny, was the housing market outlook. He's saying that he's sort of, so far it hasn't collapsed, but is that just because the government's put enough money into it? And what do we think that the outlook for the housing market is going to be more generally, both for renters and owners? So you may well be covering that anyway, but I thought it was a good time to interject that. I'll hand over to you, Jenny.
Great. Yeah, I think Camille very nicely summed up that one of the big takeaways is just that even for people who looked like they were doing okay sort of at the end of this very long expansion, there was a lot of fragility. There was a lot of vulnerability that a strong labor market sort of papered over, but that once we got into this crisis, you start to see the cracks. And obviously, I was looking very closely at the breakouts that Jeff showed us, the difference between owners and renters. You know, owners and renters are different from one another in lots of ways. Homeowners tend to be older. They tend to have more assets and higher income, even outside of homeownership. One of the big differences between them actually is race. The median white household in the U.S. owns their home. The median Black household rents their home. The median Latino household rents their home. So there are all of these layers based on top of that. But, you know, it's very clear that there were a lot of people who could just barely cover their expenses when they had a steady job and a steady income. Once they start not just losing their jobs, but just having hours cut back. So getting to Jeff's point about having income variability over time, once they start losing any of their income, they really can't cover their payments in full. You know, I thought that graph that showed that half of renters can't pay for 3 months' expenses. Well, we're 3 months into a pandemic. If you were a renter and you could just barely cover things when you were getting paid and then you lost your job, for 3 months, you know, how many people can actually float all of their bills over that period of time? You know, we have been watching, those of us in the real estate sector have been watching markets to see what's going to happen. And it's actually kind of astonishing that rental markets have held up as well as they have. The National Multifamily Housing Council has this rent payment tracker that shows, even through, I think, this week, 90% of renters in professionally managed buildings have been able to make a partial or full rent payment. You know, that seems really unlikely considering the job losses, but what it's really showing us is that the income replacement the federal government has provided so far has worked. Congress gave out stimulus checks. We had the top up to unemployment insurance, and that is the reason that people have been able to stay current on their rent. That's the reason that we haven't yet seen massive numbers of evictions, but it also suggests that when Congress pulls back on that funding, an awful lot of households are on the edge of a cliff and they are going to fall over very quickly. So I think the sort of policy lesson at this point is stimulus works, income support to household works, and as long as it's working, we should keep doing it until the labor market really recovers.
Great, thanks, Jenny. Jeff, I'm going to come back to you to pick up any responses, but there's two things in particular I'd like your further reflections on. One is the race gap that both Jenny and Camille have highlighted. And to some extent, the pandemic's just acted like an X-ray, just revealing, exposing these fractures that were there before, and then to some extent kind of reinforcing them. But in particular, the fact that some of these risk factors around wealth and financial well-being, particularly for Black Americans, just don't seem to have moved for quite a long time. So I think it's one thing that there are gaps, there's another, they just don't seem to have narrowed. In fact, recent work by our colleague Bill Gale suggests that among millennials, we're just seeing a widening of the wealth gap. And so any comments you might have about that needle doesn't seem to have moved. And so what does that mean? And then the second is, and this relates to Jenny's point about the labor market sort of papering over the cracks, and what's happening to the labor market. You were pains to say the timing of the survey was post passing of CARES, but before money started flowing. And so I'd also like your kind of reflections on what you might expect to see from subsequent evidence. So you might, in that sense, it was, you know, the timing might be very critical in terms of how vulnerable people felt at that moment in time. So anything else I'd love you to answer too from Camille and Jenny's comments, but those two stuck out for me at least.
Yeah, so I think that the points about some of these racial disparities, and particularly how Black households are faring, is absolutely spot on. I think that that's something that we see again and again in our survey, is across just a range of measures, how different people's experiences are financially based on the race. That I talked about the difference in having 3 months of emergency expenses by renters versus owners. We see the exact same thing for by race and ethnicity, that 45% of Black and anti-Hispanic adults say that they couldn't cover 3 months of expenses compared to about 23% of white adults. So we see it in measures like that. We see it in measures like I talked about the credit access. We also see it for bank account access, whether people are unbanked and have that traditional access to banking products. We also see it for things such as both people's ability to pay their current month's bills, but also we have a question asking about sort of getting at this this point of even if people look like they are getting by okay, how close are they to the edge and how close are they to financial hardships if something went wrong? Asking them, if you had a $400 expense that you had to pay, would you still be able to pay all of your current month's bills in full? And again, for measures like that, even for among among Black and Hispanic adults who have the same level of education for the, as white adults, we see disparities there. So this is something that just comes up and again and is extremely consistent through the survey, that racial and ethnic disparity. I think that in terms of this idea of your second question there about how people, the particular moment of time and were people feeling particularly financially vulnerable there, I think it cuts both ways a little bit. They, on one hand, people might have been particularly financially vulnerable because they haven't started seeing these financial benefits through things like the CARES Act showing up in their accounts and accruing to them. But on the other hand, as Camille and I were talking about earlier, this was also a period where people expected in many cases, the layoffs to be very temporary and very short term. And we are now in, again, mid-June, that and a lot of people are still out of work. So I think that that's the flip side, is that on one hand, they haven't started seeing things like the stimulus programs showing up. But I think the perceptions about how long challenges are going to last have also changed. So I think it's not obvious to me necessarily that people are going to be more optimistic then than they are now. And if anything, I actually think that for those who are still out of work, being out of work for this long presents some pretty serious challenges, especially if they don't know how long it's going to go for. And I think that one other kind of point that I want to add to there in thinking about this idea of the fact that we do have these changing financial circumstances, the fact that we conducted this survey in early April. We're going to be actually doing another survey later this summer is our plan to be able to continue to monitor this. So that's something that we are definitely very aware of, and I'm very aware of this idea that we do need to continue to track what financial circumstances are doing. We can't just sort of say, well, it looked good in early April, or to Jenny's point with the housing situation and people's ability to pay rents. Well, it looks good now, but we need to also pay attention to what's it going to be looking like down the road, and continuing to pay attention to those changes.
Thanks, Jeff. I want to ask all three of you the same question, and perhaps start with Camille and then go to Jenny and then go back to Jeff, which is all three of you study this area very closely. And so to some extent, some of this is revealing stuff that we already knew and perhaps kind of drawing more attention to it. But has there been anything either from the SHED survey or more generally that you've learned and or that surprised you, either an inequality that's greater than you thought or something you hadn't thought of, or because to some extent there's a danger that, like, for those who study these inequalities or these trends, it's not breaking news. It's just more like headline news. Stuff that was previously good for a Brookings seminar is suddenly, you know, leading the news. Or is some of it new? Camille, is there anything that's really struck you as, even I, who've looked at this a lot, didn't realize A or B?
You know, I think in one respect, I think yes. And I would say particularly information and the data on just the differences in financial well-being between people who have more than a bachelor's and people who have less. So we know in general that people who have less than a bachelor's tend to earn less. And so we would understand that they would feel slightly less secure. I think the dimensions of that were much broader and articulated in this data set than maybe are well known. Because I think what the sort of the general way we think about the last couple of years is that, you know, the economy's just been roaring ahead and everybody pretty much has jobs. And, you know, if you look around the corner, you will find a job. It just really is pretty straightforward. And we know that there's been some data that shows that the unemployment rate for Blacks has been double that of whites. But still, overall, the employment picture has been one that everybody thinks is fairly positive. I think you dig a little bit into that and you see, oh, lots of income volatility, like 30%. You know, that's a lot, right? You dig into it and you see people who own, a lot of people who own and, I mean, who rent and don't own. You see the ownership rate, home ownership rate of Black Americans has dropped significantly. And there are just, there are a lot of things there that really make me very concerned about how particularly people with sort of less than a bachelor's degree are going to be able to weather this particular storm. And so what it, the picture that it leaves for me is one of even during the height of the, you know, kind of bull market, so to speak, in a really hot economy, that there were a lot of people who had jobs, but those jobs left them feeling really fragile. And to me, that is probably one of the, I think that that's something that I think has been underappreciated most generally. And this particular SHED survey really shows the dimensions of that.
Yeah, it's right. When you see the fragility, when you put pressure on something, when you know, and we've just seen this massive pressure test, essentially, which shows it up. But also, I'm really struck by your comment about education. I mean, one of my reflections is that we knew that there are these inequalities by education, by race, by tenure, by geography, and we knew that they went together. I think that the tightness with which those things cluster together has become even more apparent, right? So the clustering of the dimensions of advantage and disadvantage, which we knew was there, is just something maybe partly because the remote working aspect, the labor market aspect, the geography aspect, it's almost as if every single dimension is being affected, and therefore the extent to which we see multi-dimensional disadvantage and multi-dimensional advantage. You know, there are some of us who feel like they're almost on every distribution, we're kind of on the lucky end of it. But there's a heck of a lot of distributions overlapping there, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. Jenny, anything that you've learned from all of this as someone that pours over these data all the time, or did you know all this already?
Not all of it. I think there are two things that have jumped out at me. One is just this sort of question of who can work from home and what that means. So I hadn't particularly thought before about whether this is important, that there are some jobs that you can do from home and some jobs you actually have to be in the office. But of course, that's really important for two reasons. One is that if you can't do the job from home and you're, you know, the workplace shuts down, the economy shuts down, you are much more likely to be laid off from work. And of course, the other side is if you have to be there in person to do the job and the public space is now a place where you get sick, the public space is hazardous. If you don't lose your job, you are vulnerable to getting sick. And so this sort of dimension of like what does it mean that you have a job that's sort of insulated where you can continue getting a paycheck and not put yourself in danger? This is a division that I hadn't thought about before, but certainly matters a lot at the moment. The other thing that I guess it wasn't a complete surprise to me, but has been frustrating is just the lack of real-time data, particularly on housing markets. So I'm incredibly glad that that Jeff and the Federal Reserve Board did this survey. I've been very grateful that the Census Bureau has been doing these pulse surveys of both small businesses and households to give us real-time data. I mentioned the National Multifamily Housing Council, which is an industry group surveying its own members, and they started doing that because we had no real-time data. We've been sort of joking that the housing economists are a little jealous of the labor economists because labor economists get weekly data on what's going on in labor markets. So it's depressing data, but they have data. The housing economists are sort of, we think the world is falling apart, but we actually don't have any data to measure that. And so we're kind of grasping at straws to put together just how bad it is. And for policymakers, I think that's really important. If all of our data are backwards looking or if they are lagged by the time they get out, it is really hard to calibrate the need going forward because we're always 3 months behind. You know, 3 months ago, households could more or less cover their bills and pay the rent. Do we need to add something now? I don't know. We really need to have more real-time indicators, not just for labor markets, but for a range of household well-being. And I think, you know, some of the questions in the shed that ask this subjective sense of well-being, you know, and the census pulse survey, do you expect that you can pay your rent or your mortgage next month? So the anticipation, because households know a lot about this, and so asking them to give us a sense of their fragility, their sense of vulnerability real time is just incredibly useful.
Thanks, Jenny. It's worth giving a shout out here, I think, to Opportunity Insights, the team out of Harvard, that are pulling together private sector and public data by geography, because sometimes it's just, if you can just pull the credit card company data or the default data or something like that, then that just is closer to what's happening in real time. But I think those are excellent comments, Jenny. Jeff, you were pulling this data together. You obviously expected some trends here, right? You expected some of your bars to be different. But even given your expectations about how different it was there anything either in your own data or other data you've seen that surprised you or that you've learned?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what really stuck out to me is the extent to which this did highlight a lot of pre-existing inequalities that existed and really magnify those. I think that I was expecting, just based on the news stories at the time that we were conducting this survey, as it was coming out, that it would be, the financial situation would be bad for everybody. And I wasn't necessarily thinking about the extent to which things like the being able to work from home is going to really just magnify inequalities. And I think that struck home to me in some sense. And there's an element where, I guess, intellectually, I kind of didn't know this in the background, but didn't necessarily think about it in quite the same way, is that even if all of the job losses hit the population equally, which they didn't, but even if they did, then you still wouldn't have a situation where the hardship that results from that is going to be felt equally. That people's financial situations leading into the pandemic, what we know from sort of years of disparities that have existed, really then does sort of exacerbate these challenges. So I think that to me, when I was thinking about what is notable about this survey and why is it something that isn't just what we already knew and it existed but now is larger news, is we haven't really had this sort of a quick short-term shock in this way before. In previous recessions, we've seen low-income workers and Black workers being more likely to have job losses early in recessions. But the magnitude and scale of this is just, it's such so different in terms of the number of people that lost their jobs early on in this crisis that really stuck out to me as something that I wasn't really fully expecting or prepared for when we were thinking about this survey.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, it's almost some of these slow motion inequalities that we've come used to seeing in trend lines over years, just sort of sped up. We're sort of seeing this just acceleration and magnification of some of these inequalities. And so, what I'd like to do now is invite all of you to think about the future. Applying what we've learned both from this moment but more broadly to what that would mean for policy prescriptions going forward. You know, what can we do both in terms of easing some of the pain of the current moment, but I would say just as importantly thinking about ways that we could reduce levels of financial kind of insecurity going forward. I'll slip in one other question as well, which has come to us from a colleague of ours out at Brookings Mountain West, Caitlin Saladino, who's particularly interested in kind of at the metro level. What should we be thinking about? She's Brookings Mountain West is based at UNLV in Las Vegas. And so you have a labor market there that's been hit kind of particularly hard. And it's also a very diverse city. And so thinking, if you're the mayor or you're the council, what should you be doing? And perhaps we can think about that both in terms of the labor market effects of the pandemic, but also the new exposure of racial inequality and the racial equity issues that have been exposed to. And Camille, you've written specific on that issue if you're a mayor at a local level. But I just invite particularly Camille and Jenny, but please chip in, Jeff, at a metro level to start with. What can cities be doing in terms of their own labor markets, their own housing markets? I'll start with you, Camille.
Well, I'm just going to say generally that one of the experiments that we tried under the CARES Act is providing people with $600 of income weekly as a support and as an addition to the $1,200 or whatever people got as a stimulus check. I think that experiment has shown that having that kind of income support keeps people away from the precipice to some degree. And as the recession kind of rolls on and it becomes pretty obvious that we're not going to reclaim the job, many of the jobs that have been lost, I think it's going to be very important to keep that income support up. I think you might have to vary that by locality. And I think local governments have to get involved to extent because if we don't have, or before we have a vaccine to deal with COVID-19, we're going to have to deal with things like, for instance, there are going to be people who cannot work because they're vulnerable, cannot go into work, and as the survey has shown, don't have an option of working at home. So there are going to be ways to support those people. We're also going to have to think about lower income households where there is high density residency as well as multi-generational residency and how we deal with that. And that is probably, money's probably going to go a long way. So there are some things that I think where income supports really thought through at the local level, but maybe funded at a federal level, I think are going to be really, really useful. I think that's the first thing. The second thing is access to credit and investments in communities of color. I think those are low hanging fruit. And I think everybody from federal financial services regulators all the way down, local banks and every locality should be thinking, how do we spend money so that we are making sure that communities of color have access to credit and also that those communities are seeing an influx of investment that in fact improves well-being, not just financial well-being, but well-being more generally.
Thank you. I think it is that's a nice link to you, I think, Jenny, and some of the work you've done in this space. Obviously, you're an expert on housing markets in particular. It may be that there's an opportunity here to fix some long-standing problems that have been highlighted, including at a local level, around wealth building more generally and the housing market, but also the intersection between the housing market, the labor market, and the credit market, as we were mentioning earlier, is just, I think, never been clearer. And so any thoughts you would have if you're you do work with certain localities, but what are the conversations you'd be having them now about what they should do now?
Sure. I think one thing that has become painfully obvious is that we should try to build up the social safety net and improve household security, financial security sort of broadly, put those policies in place when we're in the good times. We sort of let the safety net erode and, you know, let the strong labor market hide problems, and then a crisis hits and we're trying to build a safety net in real time in the midst of a health crisis and an economic crisis and now a civil rights crisis. You know, we should have a safety net before we get into crisis, not once we get there. On the housing side, there are a couple of ways that this has really shown up. So cities like Las Vegas have really large homeless populations. It turns out that having a bunch of homeless people who don't have access to sanitation, who don't have a roof over their head, who don't have the ability to shelter in place and socially distance, that's really dangerous for homeless people. It's also really dangerous for communities. So, you know, maybe this provides some stimulus for local governments to focus really seriously on reducing the homelessness rate, reducing housing insecurity. As Camille mentioned, it's pretty dangerous when you have households crowded in together in lots of space and they can't distance. We have a lot of old, poor quality housing, which is not great to live in when there are respiratory ailments going on. So we've just sort of ignored these problems and pushed them off into the corners. And I hope that at least this is going to provide a little bit of impetus. You know, I think Camille has a really good point that most of the funding for this is going to have to come from the federal government. In part because local governments and state governments are really feeling a budget pinch right now. Their revenue sources are way down. Things like sales taxes have taken an enormous hit. The demands on public services from local governments have gone way up at the same time. The federal government is the only one that can print money, and so it needs to be sending out checks not only to households, but to local governments to help them deal with these sort of fundamental insecurities and lack of safety net policies. local governments are going to wind up implementing a lot of this on the ground. And so they should be thinking about, if they get some more resources, what can they do, not just to tide people over the next 3 months and 6 months, but how do you start addressing these fundamental insecurities, put people onto a path for better jobs so that more people are going to have options in the future? How do you start putting in place the public health infrastructure to take care of this? Because almost certainly this won't be our last pandemic. How do you fix some of the housing insecurities, access to credit? Now, I will say one of the things that was a little unexpected to me about the credit access, we're starting to see more households who are trying to pay their rent with a credit card, which isn't normally a great idea given that you pay high interest rates on it, but it's a whole lot better than getting evicted right now. But households who don't have a credit card can't pay their rent on it, which means they really don't have something to fall back on. You know, in the longer run, we have to come up with a better way for households to build wealth, in particular to build liquid wealth that they can tap into when they need to tide themselves over. Relying on people to buy a house and build equity over 30 years doesn't necessarily help you for sort of 3 to 6 months of needing to tap into some liquid resources, some savings account. And we really just don't have a plan for that.
And that's been particularly true, of course, for Black Americans and Americans of color more generally, which is the promise of the equity and wealth you can build through the housing market. It's always the sort of promise that will come later. As so a recession hits and the wealth is lost again. So those alternatives, I think, are important. In fact, I think it might even Las Vegas, one of the most striking images of the pandemic was of the homeless people with 6 feet lines shown to be 6 feet apart. And so again, it's kind of exposed some of those existing inequalities in the housing market more generally. Jeff, I'm going to invite you to think a bit about some of the implications of your own work. I realize that you're somewhat constrained in your ability to talk about policy, but we could just pretend it's just us, forget about the hundreds of people watching, and just imagine it's just the four of us, you know, just chatting quietly. So I'd encourage you to throw caution to the winds and make some policy.
Well, certainly, as you mentioned, I certainly can't get ahead of the Federal Reserve and don't want to be accused by them of trying to make policy. But I mean, I think that what this does highlight is some of the places where policymakers can be certainly looking at issues and sort of where people actually have financial security and where they don't. One of the things that does stand out to me a little bit in thinking about some of these results from the survey is the length of time that it took for people to be building the financial resources that they had, and as limited as they were for some people. That when we first started the survey back in 2013, for our question on how you would pay the $400 emergency, we saw that half of people said at that point said that they would borrow, sell something, or couldn't pay this expense. And only half would be paying basically using cash. And it was only in 2019 that it was up to 63%. So you had this continued growth over the course of the expansion. My expectation to some extent is that if people are building that or drawing down those savings now, what's that thing going to do to their ability to handle whatever comes next if they're having to deplete those resources right now? And I think another sort of area that stands out from the survey that might be of some relevance is thinking about people's retirement savings and who has retirement savings and who doesn't, which feels in some sense very far off. But if people are then, one, that's a potential source that people are able to turn to be able to weather short-term shocks. But if people then are turning to these retirement savings, I mean, I think it's 35-40% of people say that they feel like they're not on track with their retirement savings already. If they're then using that as the resource to be able to weather short-term challenges now, is that going to then push people even farther behind? So I think I'm certainly not going to make any recommendations about what policymakers should actually be doing, but I think that there is a lot in the survey that people who are able to think more deeply about policy are able to potentially turn to as they're thinking about what some of these trade-offs actually look like.
We'll have a chat. We'll have a little chat afterwards, maybe. I'm sorry, that was very unfair of me. We have a few minutes left and just a couple of questions that I think will help me to shape another round. This will probably be particularly aimed at Jenny and Camille, because it specifically is about kind of policy and addressing the race gap in wealth building and wealth more generally. One of the questions we've had is, whether or not the race gap that has been referred to already, whether that still holds when you add kind of controls for education, et cetera. And the answer is yes. You know, that's a partial explanation, but we see a strong race gap even with those covariates kind of added in. And a couple more questions about race too. And so obviously the issue of the very different position in terms of you know, white households and black households in particular that we've referred to a number of times now already is getting more attention perhaps now than it has done for some time. We're seeing HR 40, which is the annually presented bill to create a commission to study reparations for black Americans, getting a lot more attention than before. We're seeing the work of people like Sandy Darity, Derek Hamilton on baby bonds getting much more attention, etc. And so I just wanted to invite Jenny and Camille and just reflect on whether you think that some of the approaches to wealth building, some of which I've mentioned, but there'll be others as well, whether or not we need a specific, either a race specific or race conscious element to those wealth building strategies, as well as the broader based approach that we'll have given the inequities that have been highlighted in recent months. So I'll come to you first, Jenny, if you don't mind, and then come to you, Camille. And I will say that Rashawn Ray and Andre Perry, two of our colleagues, have written recently on the issue of reparations, and I encourage people to kind of check that out. But I don't want to make this narrowly about reparations, Jenny, but it's just more broadly that the case for race conscious or race specific wealth building strategies more generally.
Yeah, I would say that we still have a lot of pretty overt racial barriers. So obviously in the housing world, one of the big impediments to low-income renters moving into high-opportunity neighborhoods, places with good schools and access to jobs, are the policies that local governments have put into place on exclusionary zoning. So if you make it impossible to build apartments in a high-opportunity neighborhood, then renters don't have access to all of the resources there, which means that, you know, low-income families with kids can't get their kids into the best school systems because they can't afford to live in those school systems. They can't afford the housing there. That's not explicitly racial zoning, but it has very disproportionate effects by race. And so, you know, getting rid of a lot of the exclusionary zoning would disproportionately help Black and Latino families who are renters. It's also just hard to ignore that kids who are born into a family that has some resources, that has assets, have a leg up at every stage in their life. Their parents can use the money to help them do tutorials and summer programs and enrichment programs, help them pay for college, you know, help pay the down payment on a house or to start a small business. So at every stage of your life, if your family has money, your family has wealth, you do better. Black households in particular don't have as much wealth because they have been systematically excluded from wealth building for generations. And so the argument that we should provide a lump sum of resources to families, particularly families with kids, that's then at their disposal and they can use that as they go forward in life, there's a really strong case to be made both on fairness and on economic efficiency arguments.
Thank you. Camille, I'm going to give what I think will be the last word to you, which I think allows us to tie together these issues of race, inequity, wealth, and economic security more broadly. Your own work shows that you see downward mobility for Black kids, particularly conditional on income, a huge wealth gap. And so this kind of risk is just very disproportionate. Being middle class and Black is not the same as being middle class and white. I think that's, you know, beyond it. And so what are your thoughts right now in terms of wealth building more broadly, but specifically, should it be race, you know, race conscious, race specific?
Well, thanks very much, Richard. And I would agree with everything that Jenny just mentioned. The one thing I would say in addition to that is that the scale of the problem is so immense that it does require a massive kind of policy intervention. And in this case, you know, there are a lot of, there have been a lot of all kinds of proposals, but I would say that the primary issue is that income still is hard for Black communities and Black households and Black men and Black women to come by at the same level that their white counterparts combine. And so I do think there is you know, just because of the scale of the problem, which is the result of intentional policies, then requires a massive policy intervention to correct something that took hundreds of years, you know, was hundreds of years in the making. And the other thing that I would just say in general is that, you know, we always think about fairness and, you know, we got to this place because of a set of unfair policies. And so we need to undo those. And undoing that is the kind of fairness principle. And last thing that I'll say is that, you know, all of us are really affected by racism, whether we're white or we're black or anything else. When you live in a world where there's a lot of untapped potential, you are affected by that. When you live in a world where people are segregated and can't be participant in the economy, and that has a whole sort, all sorts of ramifications, as we've seen with COVID-19, greater, you know, vulnerability to the disease, et cetera, we are all affected. So there are many reasons to think about a massive policy intervention to address this problem.
Thank you, Camille. But thank you to all of you. Thank you, Jeff, for bringing us your data and sharing it with us, as well as sharing your time. Thank you, Jenny, for your time and for having the original inspiration for this event, as well as your own work on housing. And thank you, Camille, for your leadership of our Race, Prosperity and Inclusion Initiative and the new blog, How We Rise, which draws attention to the very issues we've been discussing today. Thank you to all of those of you who joined us and those who've asked questions. Please watch this space and stay safe.